As we've been going through Matthew, one of the good things about it, from my perspective, is when you go through, take a book and go through it, chapter by chapter, verses by verses, then sometimes you come across things that you might not have thought to preach on, and you preach on those things. Other times you come across things that you might rather have not preached on, and you either have to skip it and pretend it wasn't there, or you have to preach on those things. Well, tonight is one of that second category that it's an important subject, an important topic, and it's one that often is sorely misrepresented and often ignored, and often there are all sorts of false things taught on the subject. But it's not a pleasant subject. It's not one that I particularly like to preach about. And there are several of those that I don't like to preach. But part of being a preacher is preaching the whole counsel of God, and that means sometimes preaching things you don't like to preach. It's always good to get to preach a happy sermon. It's always good to get to preach an encouraging sermon, or one where people learn something that they didn't know before. Those are wonderful things. Sometimes there's a need to rebuke sin, and that's not really a very pleasant task many times. Sometimes there's a need to teach doctrine that it has been misrepresented and mistaught over the years, and that has to be done as well. In case you've forgotten where we are, it has been a couple of weeks, three I guess, we're in Matthew chapter 19. And so we'll start there in verse number 1, and we'll go down through verse 12 tonight. And as I begin this, I don't want you to think that I'm going to thoroughly exhaust this subject in the little bit of time that we have together tonight. Entire books have been written on this subject. Debates have been made on this subject. And the there have been numerous different things that have been discussed on this subject. So I'm not going to answer every question in the whole wide world tonight on this subject. But what I am going to do is deal with these few verses and what Jesus has to say to us in them, as well as the others that speak in this discussion that they have. Jesus had taught briefly on the subject of divorce back in Matthew chapter 5 and verses 31 and 32 in the Sermon on the Mount. The Pharisees apparently had missed that. They weren't a part of that group, or didn't, but maybe heard about it from somebody else and wanted to go see what Jesus really thought about this subject. And if you remember back in Matthew chapter 5, maybe you don't. I barely did. But when we covered those two verses, I said at that time, we'll deal with this more extensively when we get to chapter 19. So here we are. Jesus has come back to the area near the Jordan River. And multitudes of people are still following Him. He's still healing the sick and doing some teaching as well. And the Pharisees in verse 3 are up to their same old tricks. And here they come tempting Him, Matthew says. They were always trying to trip Jesus up. Have you ever noticed how some people like to make others look bad in an attempt to make themselves look better? The Pharisees thought that if they could just knock Jesus off of that pedestal of perfection that He was on, they'd look better. Of course, they always failed, but that didn't keep them from trying again. And so here they come, and they've got a good question this time. They've got a tricky one. This question is about divorce, and anyone who's ever talked with someone about the issue of divorce knows that's a sticky subject, and so they think maybe they can get Jesus with this subject. Their question is it lawful? And when they say lawful, they're asking about according to the law of Moses, which to them was God's law that they were living under. So is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? That's an interesting question. And it's a good question if it were asked honestly. which they weren't asking, honestly. They were trying to tempt Jesus and trick Jesus. But it's a valid question. They're asking, in essence, what is God's rule about marriage and divorce? Now, the approach that most in the church today seem to take focuses on the question of whether someone can remarry after they've divorced. And that is a valid question as well. But that's not the question the Pharisees asked. They weren't even asking about the remarriage part. They just want to know, can we get rid of our wives? Is it okay for us to divorce? That's what they want to know. And so Jesus answers the question, which focuses on the divorce. Now, there are many, like the Pharisees in the church today, who say, yeah, you can divorce for any reason, but you're limited on when you can remarry. I want to be as kind through this subject as possible, because I know that a lot of people have experienced a lot of pain in regards to marriage and divorce. It's not a subject that we say, well, that's off out there and it never affects us. It's affected a lot of people in the church. It's affected a lot of families. And so we want to certainly have concern and compassion for those who are affected by it. We want to remember, however, we're looking at what God's idea is. What is God's law? What does He want? And when we do that, it may seem cold. It may seem uncompassionate. People may say, well, you don't know about my circumstances. And that's true. I may not know everyone's circumstances. But God has a law. He has commands about things that set things up to be the way He wants them to be. It's our job as human beings to strive to reach that standard that He's set. We don't always do it. We fail sometimes. In the area of divorce, the Bible is very clear that God hates divorce. Now, there aren't many things in the Bible. There's a few things that the Bible says that God hates. Proverbs talks about 6 things that the Lord hates, 7 that are an abomination to Him, and lists those things there. And there are some other passages that talk about things that God hates. God hates divorce. And you know what I've found, though, is talking to people, and particularly to people who have ever gone through a divorce, every sane person that I've ever talked to that's gone through a divorce hates divorce, too. It's a miserable experience. And so it's something to be avoided at all costs, if possible. And if we can start there and understand that God doesn't like it, in fact, He hates it, He doesn't want anything to do with it, and He doesn't want us to suffer from it. You know, a lot of the things God hates, He hates because He knows it causes His children pain. And that's one of the reasons that He hates divorce. He knows that it destroys a family and that it breaks hearts and tears people to shreds, and it's stressful. And in fact, divorce is one of the top 3 things that is stressful to a human being. And God knew that. And that's one of the reasons that He hates it. There are certainly probably other reasons, and some that we may not even know of, that He hates it. He doesn't give us all His reasons. But notice their question was, is it lawful? But in verse 4, what Jesus does is He goes back beyond the law. He goes back before the law. He goes all the way back to the beginning. And He focuses His attention on what marriage is and how it started. And sometimes that gets lost in the discussion of marriage and divorce and remarriage. Sometimes people get caught up in technicalities. Well, what if? And what if this? And what if that? And we need to remember what Jesus talks about here. And we need to especially impress on our young people who haven't gotten married yet how important it is to understand what marriage is, how sacred it is, how the gravity of the situation when we choose to enter into that relationship. And our society today has completely lost touch with that. They have no idea. When they enter into a marriage relationship as easily as they sign up for a cell phone contract. They take it so lightly. Well, if I don't like it, I can cancel it. And that's not what Jesus says marriage is all about. He says, back in the beginning, God made them male and female. That's what it was. And God was there at the beginning, and God started this thing of marriage. And you notice He defines marriage there as between one man and one woman. Now we know, if we've read the Old Testament, that there were some times when sometimes there was one man and three or four women, or 1,000 in Solomon's case. That wasn't God's plan. That wasn't the way God wanted it to be. Originally, He intended for one man and for one woman. And Jesus is bringing us back to God's original intent for the way marriage is supposed to be. Those, of course, today who are trying to redefine marriage to include homosexuality and who knows what else. I heard a story not long ago about a woman who had married a bridge, and I read about a man over in India that married his dog. That's not marriage. That's not. Now, they can call it marriage. They can use that term. But that is not marriage. God instituted marriage, and He defines what it is. And so He said that marriage was between a man and a woman. So those that are trying to redefine marriage today certainly don't have any support from Jesus in their efforts. But in verse 5, Jesus says that this man and his wife become one flesh when they get married. Now that's something that God does. I mean, we look, we see, well, here's they're still two people. They're not one flesh. But God said they are. God has put them together and joined them together in the process of that marriage, in a way that is unseen to human eyes if it's done according to God's will. In fact, this terminology where it talks of them being one flesh is a term that's not used of any other relationship. Even a mother that's with child, she's got the child inside her, and yet it's never said that they're one flesh. It always speaks of them as two separate individuals, and yet in the marriage relationship, God says they become one flesh. It's interesting also that Jesus attributes the saying where, according to Genesis 2:24, Adam said, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Jesus attributes that saying to God. So either Adam was inspired to speak that, or else he was simply repeating something that God had already said when that's recorded in Genesis 2:24. Jesus, in verse 6, says that true marriage involves an action by God, where God actually does this joining of these two individuals in such a way that then He says man is not supposed to separate it. The King James says, "Let no man put asunder." That means don't separate what God's put together. But you know, man's good at trying to separate things God's put together. There are several examples of that. God has put old age and respect together. He has put faith and works together. He has joined grace and responsibility together. He has joined love and obedience. He has joined sin and guilt. He has joined salvation and the church. And He has joined baptism and forgiveness of sin. He said these two things are together. You can't have one without the other, in essence. And the same thing is true of what He said of the man and woman who become husband and wife. These two are together, and you can't have one without the other anymore. God's original plan. Now we think about this. God created Adam. He created Eve. He married them right there in the garden. The first wedding ceremony wasn't an elaborate one. She didn't have a fancy dress. In fact, as far as we know, she didn't have any clothes. That was before the sin. And there they were in the Garden of Eden, created by God, designed to live forever, and He married them, and the design originally was for marriage to be unending. It was to last forever. But sin and death entered the picture. And so the unending part became until death do us part, as the old saying goes that's said so many times in wedding ceremonies. And so Adam and Eve were joined together until one of them died. And that's then the way it remained. For hundreds of years, that was the way God's law remained until the law of Moses came along. But Jesus tells them all of these things about how it was supposed to be, what marriage was all about. We need to understand that, and we need to teach the young people how important it is to choose carefully, to choose wisely, to be patient and not rush in. And it's hard for young people when their hormones are raging and they want to get married right now. And it's hard for them to even consider the idea of being patient and thinking through this possibility of whether this is right or not. But Jesus said, since it was something that was intended to last forever, it's not something to be taken lightly. It's not something to be rushed into. Verse 7, then, they asked the obvious question. Because Jesus has just told them, from the beginning, there was no divorce. God said, here you are, husband, wife, together, you're one forever till the end of your lives. There was no idea or concept of divorce in that when God put Adam and Eve together. And so they asked the obvious question, if we're not supposed to get divorced, then why did Moses tell, they say command, they almost say it like Moses gave them a command to get a divorce. Why did Moses command us to give her a letter and then send her on her way and divorce her? That's the question they ask. And it really was that easy in Jewish law at the time that Christ lived. A man didn't like his wife, he could just write a little letter that said, I don't want her to be my wife anymore, and give it to her and send her out the door. And she was gone. There was no 50-50 split of assets or no divorce court to see who got the children. No, I mean, it's just he gave her the paper and sent her out the door and that was it. They're making reference to Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, where Moses deals with divorce and does give those details of how a divorce could take place. Another thing that comes along with this subject is it touches on some touchy subjects in regard to the physical relationship within marriage as well. And so we'll try to be gentle with that, of course, because we have children present, but we have to deal with that as well. What Moses' law really said here in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1 and following was that he couldn't just divorce her for any reason. That wasn't what Moses' law said. In fact, it said that if he finds some, the King James translates the word uncleanness in that passage. That's the only time it translates it that way. In every other passage where that word is used, that Hebrew word is used, it's translated nakedness. So what Moses told them was that if he, after he marries her, he finds some nakedness in her, he finds some sexual immorality in her, then he can write her a bill of divorcement and send her away. And this is the idea of something shameful or disgraceful that she has done to deserve being put away from her husband. It had reference, obviously, to one of the major things at that time, which was the misrepresentation of a bride as being a virgin when she was not. And that was certainly one of the things. If he married her and found that she was not a virgin, as it was claimed by her parents that she was, then she could be put away. He didn't have to remain married to her. In fact, nearly half of the times this word is used are in Leviticus chapter 18. And it won't take you very far reading in Leviticus chapter 18 to find it, and it won't take you very long to figure out what this word means. There, again, it is translated nakedness, and it always refers to improper relationships that should not be taking place. And this is the word that Moses used to tell a husband when it was okay for him to divorce his wife. By Jesus' time, though, the Pharisees had taken liberties with that word. And they had redefined that word to mean anything that I don't like about my wife. She burnt the toast. She didn't keep the house clean enough. Whatever. And any excuse they could find. And they were writing bills of divorcement. She got too old. I wanted a younger one. Whatever. They just, any reason. That's what the question they asked was, wasn't it? Can a man divorce for any reason? Because that's what they were doing. Sound familiar? Sounds a lot like our society today, doesn't it? Don't like this one, get rid of that one, and get another one. You see, sometimes we think we're so far advanced from those people that lived 2,000 years ago. You know, technology can change. People can invent all sorts of new contraptions of one kind or another. But human nature seems to always remain the same. And these people were still trying to do this. Now I want us to remember too here again. They asked about putting away or divorcing a wife. And some might think that that was just because, well, these were men asking Jesus the question. That's not why. The reason they asked about a man putting away his wife was because that was the only thing that was legal. A woman didn't have any right to divorce a husband, no matter what he had done. There was no right. Under the law of Moses, when a man took a wife, she was his. In the same sense that when he bought a cow, it was his. Or bought a house, it was his. The wife became his. As a possession almost. As a piece of property. Now we're kind of disturbed by that thought today. This is a human being. That's not property, that's a person. But that's not the way the law of Moses saw those transactions. A marriage was subjugating a woman to her husband, and she lost her rights to anything beyond what he said for her. We need to remember that as well. Verse 8, Jesus points out, first of all, that they're misquoting what Moses said. There never was a command to divorce. Even in those times where a woman was found to be unclean, as with Hosea and Gomer, where she went off into harlotry and prostitution. There was no command that they had to divorce. Hosea went after Gomer 3 times. He had to go get her back. And he did. What an amazing love story that is. He loved her so much that he'd go back and get her even when she was leaving him to go into prostitution. He'd go back and get her again and bring her back because he loved her so much. You have to wonder if she ever, ever learned to love him like he loved her. But Jesus points out it was not a command to divorce, only an allowance that was made because of the hardness of the human heart. He reminds them that it was not supposed to be that way from the beginning. This is one of those areas that Acts 17:30 talks about. At the times of this ignorance, God winked, but now commands all men everywhere to come to repentance. You know, God allowed some things. He kind of overlooked. He turned a blind eye. He winked at some of the things that were going on back in those Old Testament times that were not what He wanted. They weren't the way He wanted it to be, but He let it go. But when Christ came, He said, now, everyone everywhere. Everyone everywhere needs to come to repentance. And so, as we look at this and we think about what Jesus is saying, He points these things out. We realize the law of Moses only applied to the Jews for about 1,200 years, give or take. That was it. But the law of Christ applies to everyone worldwide from the time of His death and the beginning of that law at the day of Pentecost until the end of time. And Christ's law will continue to be in effect. And so Jesus, finally in verse 9, weighs in on what God really wants for mankind. Now, we already established that what God really wants is for there to never be a single divorce. What He really wants is for a man and a woman to get married and to love each other and dwell in that bond of matrimony to the end of their lives. That's what He wants. That's the way He established it. That's the way He planned it. But Jesus actually says something similar to what Moses had said. Remember, Moses had given the one reason, that nakedness or uncleanness, for them to divorce. And Jesus similarly gives one reason. He says, fornication. Now, sometimes, and I've often heard, and probably will continue to often hear, people say that the only reason Jesus gave for divorce is adultery. That's not what He said. He said fornication. They're two different words. They have two different meanings. They're very similar, but they are different. And that important, that difference is important and it is significant. For example, fornication is a little broader term. It includes types of sexual misconduct and immorality that are not included in adultery. Let me give you an example. Suppose a couple are engaged to be married, and the night before the wedding, the bride-to-be sleeps with another man. That's happened on many occasions, I would imagine. The groom finds out the day after the wedding. Now, she didn't commit adultery because they weren't married when she did that. But she did commit fornication. And according to what Jesus said, He would have the right to divorce her when He found that out. If we use the term adultery, then He stuck with her even though He married her under that false pretense, not knowing that she had done that the night before their wedding. Another situation, and one of which I know of case where this actually occurred, and it was brought to some elders, and they said, well, no, she can't remarry. She doesn't have a scriptural reason for divorce. In a case where a woman's husband had molested their children. Now, often in molestation, there's not full contact, if we say it that way. But wouldn't we all agree that it is sexual immorality? And yet they say, oh no, because technically he didn't commit adultery. So Jesus' use of the term fornication is a little broader, not a lot, but it is a little broader than the term adultery would be. And it allows a few situations that the term adultery would not. But we want to be reminded again that Jesus here is not mandating divorce even in those situations of fornication. There's not a command to divorce. Now, I can certainly understand why many people would, under those circumstances, especially in today's climate with all of the transmitted diseases that are out there, a physical danger to remain in a relationship with someone who's promiscuous like that. It makes sense. But I have known of people who overcame that infidelity and stayed married and worked it out. And there's certainly nothing wrong with them overcoming that and working it out. But what Jesus is acknowledging with this exception that he gives is that sometimes divorce is the lesser of two evils. It's something God hates. But unfaithfulness, infidelity, is something God hates as well. And sometimes it is less bad to suffer through the process of the divorce than to remain in the relationship with someone who's not going to be faithful in that relationship. Now, just in case anyone thinks Jesus has not made a radical statement here, or thinks, well, that's the way they thought back then, but things are different now. You hear that all the time. Just look at his disciples' response in verse 10. Now, this isn't the Pharisees. The Pharisees they're struck dumb by this. They're mute. They don't have anything else to say when he says this. But his disciples say, well, now, Jesus, if you're telling it like it is, well, it'd be a good idea not to ever get married. See, they were so accustomed to just being able, in their society, the concept of, well, you can just get out of a marriage if it's not working out. Sound familiar? They were so used to that idea that the concept that we could be restricted to only under this circumstance could we get out of the marriage. All right, they'd be better off just not to get married at all then. Now, how do you suppose Jesus responded to that? When will we understand the gravity of entering into the marriage relationship? When will we start teaching young people the importance of choosing carefully and wisely instead of just hopping in and hoping it'll work out? When will we make it at least as hard to get married as it is to get a driver's license? I don't know about you, but I had to take a test to get a driver's license. I didn't have to do anything but sign a piece of paper to get married. How about you? There's no prerequisites. There's no counseling to take place beforehand. There's a few states that require a blood test or something like that, but it's just, we make it so easy, and so easy to get out of too many times. And when will we teach couples to work on their marriages and to work it out instead of quitting when it gets tough? You see, these are all things that go along with the ease of divorce as it is in our society today and as it was in Jesus' society. And what we've found is, as the commitment to marriage has broken down in our society, commitments to all sorts of other things are breaking down as well. You can't trust anybody on anything anymore, it seems. Used to be, if somebody said they'd do something, they'd do it. And that was kind of the way a marriage worked. They stood before a group of friends and family and said, we're going to be married. And you could trust they were going to do their best to stick it out and to make it work. And now, I don't guess in most marriages they even say, for better and for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, till death do us part. They don't even say that anymore. Because they go into it not expecting it to last. They go into it signing prenuptial agreements so that they already have it figured out how the divorce is going to go down when it happens. That's planning to fail. But you know, when the disciples react with astonishment at Jesus' teaching about divorce, He doesn't say, oh, wait, wait, you misunderstood me. It's really not that bad. It's really not as hard as you're making. No, it's not like that. That's not what he said. Instead, he says, that they've just suggested, well, it's better for a man not to get married. And he said, you know, not everybody can do what you're saying. Not everybody can handle that. And it's certainly true. Not everyone could handle being single throughout their life. Some can. Right? Jesus then says, and we have to understand, as Jesus is, remember, Jesus lived to be between 30 and 35 years old, about 33 years old. And he was tempted in all ways just like we are. He never married a woman. We know his bride is the church. But he never married a human woman, and there are a lot of reasons for that, certainly. But he was a man. And if he was tempted in all ways like other men, he was tempted by lust and by sexual desires that could not have been fulfilled outside of marriage. He faced those temptations and he overcame them. So we understand Jesus is not speaking as somebody who just doesn't know what it's like. Jesus lived a single life and it was not easy for him, I'm sure, any more than it would have been for any other person to do. But he then acknowledges in verse 12 that there are some that are born eunuchs. They're born unable to engage physically in that way. There are some who are made eunuchs physically by other people. Nehemiah would have been one of those, an example of that. Never able to have children because he was made a eunuch to be the cupbearer of the king. The king's servants were often made eunuchs in order to serve the king without a fear of or a threat to him. And he says there are some that were made that way by men. But then he says that there are some who have been made eunuchs spiritually. They've made themselves eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. And he, in essence, brags on those folks, but says what a thing it is for that group of people. There are those who have chosen the kingdom over marriage and sexuality. And it's interesting that many religions, and certainly even within Judaism, a eunuch could not fully participate in those religions. And yet, Christ opens the kingdom, His kingdom, to the eunuchs and offers the ability for them to serve in His kingdom. Now, the only limitation, of course, would be that they couldn't be an elder or a deacon, because those require marriage and children. But he opened that up. And then, of course, we see in Acts chapter 8, Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. And the Ethiopian eunuch is able to become a Christian. But Jesus makes it very clear that marriage is not to be taken lightly. It is one of very few, in fact, I can only think of two institutions that are ordained by God and that God established and that God was active in the organization of those things. Marriage and the church are the only two institutions in this world today that God actively took a part in. Now, there are a lot of things out there in the world today, and some of them God's pleased with and some God isn't pleased with. But those two things, God played an active role in establishing them. And the marriage and the church are two things that should never be taken lightly. Jesus wasn't unclear. He said what He meant. He meant what He said. But we have many today who, because they don't like what Jesus said, they want to change it. There are many things in the Scriptures that we may come across that may not please us. We may not like them. many commands, many things we're supposed to do that we may not like. Those are the areas where we really get to answer the question, have I submitted my will to Christ? Am I willing to do what Jesus wants instead of what I want? And this is one of those areas. One of the areas where it will be a separating ground. Are we willing to stand for what Jesus said, even though we personally might not like it? Because we know it's what Jesus said. There are other areas like that as well. We see them every day. Salvation is one of those areas. Jesus said what someone must do to be saved. He laid out the plan for salvation. And people don't like it, and so they come up with their own. But the real question is, am I going to submit my will to Christ, or am I going to try to do it my own way? If you're here tonight and you have not submitted yourself to Christ, maybe in this area or maybe in some other area of your life, you need to do that today. Get your will in line with His will. Because only those that are under His will He come back to save. If you have a need to respond to God's invitation tonight, please do so as we stand and as we sing.